Hey, everybody, and welcome. It's Friday, January 17th, 2020. I'm still not used to saying that. My name is Daniel Bader. This is the Android Central podcast. And joining me this week, returning to our show, Ara Wagner. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I am
in a new apartment, and I'm very much looking forward to leaving my apartment and going to the parks this weekend.
All right. Well, we'll give you a bit of free time there. We won't take too long. Jerry Hildenbrand, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. How are you?
I'm okay. It's Friday. It's good. It's sunny. It's cold. You know how we do on this side of the earth.
It's like Canada here now, too, baby.
Yeah, man. We're exporting our sorry. We're exporting our sorry down there. We're getting 15 centimeters of snow. What does that translate to in American?
About 6 inches or so.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Something
of snow,
like anyway. That.
So I'm gonna enjoy the sun while we have it. All right, enough weather. Let's talk Android. So we just did a CES podcast. It's there was a lot of stuff out of CES this year, but nothing mind blowing. But in the meantime, we've had a lot of news, and this week the S20 just started leaking left and right. And we now have hands-on images. We now have a summary of what's going on with the cameras. We now have a date for the event. We now have a pretty good idea of the SKUs. There's going to be like 5 or 6 SKUs if you count the 5G versions. And we basically know everything about it except how it feels in the hand, right? We don't know if Samsung is going to do anything major to the software, but hardware-wise, we are getting a better idea. So let's jump into that. And later on in the show, we'll talk a bit about the new Pixel 4a leaks. We'll talk about some EU regulations that are potentially quite controversial. And Jerry, I want you to dig into what you think about the new OnePlus Concept 1 and how OnePlus is going to balance 120 hertz screens and battery life. And if we have some time, we'll talk about Steam on the Chromebooks, because that was a juicy leak or a rumor, I guess, this morning from David Ruddick at Android Police. So let's start S20. Ara, when you see the S20, there's three models, S20, S20 Plus, and now a rumored Ultra version. What goes through your mind? What is Samsung doing with itself?
The first thing that comes to mind is, why are we going back to this 2010 era naming scheme where we have an S20, we have an S20 Plus, we have an S20 5G, we have an S20 Plus 5G, and we have this Pro or Ultra 5G model? I mean, like, come on, guys. We went through this already. We know how to name a phone better than this. I'm not a huge fan of the huge camera modules on the back, mostly because they just make it harder to find a cute case for a phone, or even just find a decent case for a phone. When the camera module is that big, there's just more that's exposed. I believe in protecting my phones. No matter your taste, your phone needs a case.
Yeah, you got to find like a rhyming tagline that you're almost there. But that should be like your tagline whenever you introduce yourself. Hi, I'm Ara Wagner. If you want to,
no matter your taste, your phone needs a case. That's the badge on a lot of my case roundups.
So there are 5 SKUs, Jerry, but we're not really sure what's going on with the 5G ones, because the rumor has it all of the Qualcomm powered versions will just be 5G anyway. So Samsung may or may not call them Galaxy S20 5G. They may just be Galaxy S20, and then 5G will be implied. But in other parts of the world, where the Exynos version doesn't come with 5G on board, you know, it will be 5G capable, but not every single Exynos 9900 is going to be 5G powered.
Exactly what I was thinking. Yeah, the North American versions are just going to be the S20 Plus and Ultimate, and 5G is implied.
Super mega.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're still in that sort of transition year where every model may or may not have 5G enabled, right? We know that the Qualcomm 865, the Snapdragon 865 will have 5G on board regardless, but some vendors, some carriers may choose to disable it or just, you know, not offer it. What is your thought around what Samsung is doing here by going ultra, right? What is this need to sort of continue making the phone so much bigger, even though we've kind of reached the limit of what our hands can deal with?
Well, my biggest problem there is with the name, but for a different reason from Era's problem with the name. Ultra implies that the regular version isn't very good. Yeah. And that's, I don't know, maybe that's how my mind works. But when I hear you can buy the S20, the S20 Plus, or the S20 Ultra, I just think, well, the other two must not be very ultra at all. And then I find out that they mean the size. So, you know, everybody thinks differently, but I think that was a swing and a miss with the name. And I, you know what? Then if they're going to do it, just stick an S Pen in it and do away with the Note. The S20 Ultra is now the new Galaxy Note.
Especially because we had a Note Lite that came out literally 2 weeks ago. Like, come on, guys. There's only so many derivatives you can make here. And Jerry, a problem with the Ultra is that I just instantly go anime with it. Especially since My Hero Academia is the huge thing and Go Beyond Plus Ultra. And I'm like, oh, there's a Galaxy S20 Plus and there's a Galaxy S20 Ultra. Cool.
Okay. That's to each their own. I love you anyway.
Okay, so we do know that there are going to be some hardware differences in the Ultra version. Specifically, Jerry, the fact that the rear camera, the primary sensor on the Ultra is rumored to be the new 108 megapixel, super condensed, sensor from, I think it's Samsung that's building the 108, or maybe it's Sony. Samsung has a 64 megapixel. But, you know, obviously it's using pixel binning to increase the size of the overall pixels after processing.
Right.
And when you choose to use all 108 megapixels, you are getting considerably more resolution. But the other two versions are rumored to have a larger 12 megapixel sensor than the previous three versions of the Galaxy line. So Galaxy S8, S9, and S10 all used a variant of the Exynos or the Exmor 360 series, and they have 1.4 micron pixels. This is rumored to be 1.8 microns, which is better, right? And paired with the dual aperture, the f/1.5, widest aperture, we could have much better low light performance on this phone. But what are the differences, right? Fundamentally, between a large 12 megapixel sensor and, say, a slightly physically larger but much higher, much denser 108 megapixel sensor?
I'm trying to think of the right way to say this so everybody will understand and so I don't sound like I'm trying to impress people with big words. Megapixel count doesn't matter nearly as much on these tiny little sensors as people think it does, for starters. The only company I ever think that did any huge megapixel count right was Nokia, and that was because they used it to gather information and then cut 80% of it away on, what was it, the 1020, I think, the Nokia 1020. So right. They had some sort of camera that had 100 and some odd megapixel.
Yeah, I remember that one.
It collected that information but used it to create a more refined image and threw out half the megapixel count, so you didn't end up with a 200 megabit JPEG. I just recently wrote something about sensor size on cameras and how it's designed so it looks great on the screen in your hands. And most good cameras nowadays will look great on a 27-inch, 30-inch monitor or even on your TV. But when it comes to comparing them to bigger sensors, it's different because of the sensor size. Samsung increasing the base size from 1.2 to 1.4 microns on the non-ultra versions, I think, is a much bigger and possibly more breakthrough kind of thing than having some 100 megapixel plus camera on the Ultra. I'd love to be surprised and I'd love to be wrong, but I really think that people are going to be disappointed when they think they've got a 100 megapixel camera and then they see what it can do.
Right. So 108 megapixels is a lot, but every photo is interpolated down to 27 megapixels using, you know, a quad Bayer type of system.
And then it gets compressed down to free upload quality on Google Photos and doesn't matter anyway.
That's true. I mean, if you are uploading it anywhere, 27 megapixels is useless. But yeah, I mean, it preserves a lot more detail. And presumably, and this is a Samsung sensor, I just checked. Presumably, the sensor itself is going to be quite physically large, right?
You know, hopefully.
You mentioned the PureView camera on the Lumia 1020. That physical sensor was, at the time, the largest we'd ever seen. Yeah. The reason Huawei can claim that some of its processing is so good is because it starts out with just a massive physical primary sensor. And then it just has, you have the best of both worlds. You have larger physical pixels as well as more detail to work with. So, and here you have way more because it's 108 megapixels altogether.
A lot of people don't understand. You say the word larger pixels, they think that's a bad thing because on your screen, you want tiny pixels. But on your camera, you want giant pixels.
Right.
So that's something for everybody out there to keep in mind, too. It's going to be really interesting, but I'm still going to say that I'll bet we're more impressed with the smaller, air quote, cameras that are on the other two just because of the larger individual pixel size, how much better they were than the 2019 version.
So the other thing that the Ultra may have that the S20 and S20 Plus don't have is a fifth camera altogether. So let's run them down while we have the rumored spec sheet in front of us. A main 12 megapixel or 108 megapixel primary sensor with, you know, a wide angle. Then we have a rumored 10x optical sensor, a 48 megapixel sensor with a 10 times optical zoom, which is a lot and could be completely game changing if the quality is good.
Right.
There's a 12 megapixel ultra wide camera on all three. Then there's an unknown camera. So we've seen the photos of the back of the phone. We're not sure what that fourth camera is, but it's possible it's a depth sensor. It's possible it's a time of flight sensor. We're not sure.
It's, and then on the Ultra, something
on the Ultra, there's a fifth lens that is rumored to be a macro lens. And Jerry, I would love your take on this, because whenever I get a phone that has a macro mode and it actually works, it becomes one of my favorite modes to use.
It's fun, isn't it?
It's awesome.
But even you take a one of the great phones that take great pictures, like a Pixel or a Galaxy S10 or a Huawei. I haven't tried the P30, but the P20, they all take great pictures. But we've all seen that message, move further back for better focus. Well, if you have a macro lens, you don't get that. And you can take some really neat photographs and have a lot of fun with it. It's very difficult to do unless you have a dedicated lens. So I'd love to see it there.
I'd love to hear your thoughts, Ara, on, you know, where you think the sweet spot will be this year. Because there was a lot of talk about how with the S10, most people got the Plus because people just want the best phone if they can afford it. And then many people got the S10e because it was cheaper and it was smaller. And the S10
and it had
just
a regular
got,
fingerprint sensor. Which
and it,
doesn't
it had
get
a regular
credit.
Fingerprint sensor. That's true. And I actually, that was one of my favorite features about it. And then this year, we're looking at the S20 Plus being sort of that middle child that nobody pays attention to. But that seems weird, right? What's your take on what Samsung's doing?
I don't know why they're doing this many models this year, unless it's a matter of the 520 and the 520 and the S25G is just a matter of which market gets which could very well be. But I don't get having three every year, because that means you have to have X many SKUs. You have to market each and every model, and you have to get accessories for each and every model. And that's not really a great move for anybody, because that just makes everything more confusing.
And in North America, you have to convince the carriers to want to stock and push each and every model.
Yep.
Yeah, it does seem like Samsung, of all the companies, though, is the best prepared for that kind of onslaught, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, how many smartphones do they release in a year? It's got to be north of 50.
Yeah, I mean, just in Korea, in India, in China, those local SKUs, yeah. I don't know 50, but definitely like 20 to 30, I would say. That would actually be an interesting topic to look into, right? Every single little difference.
In just the last 60 days, not counting any thing for the S20 that's coming, we have had the S10 Lite, the Note 10 Lite, the A51, and the A71. That's four models before we get to any major events for the year.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be interesting. And that just seems to be the trend every company is following, right? Release more phones, make them more tailored to every possible demographic and location, optimize them for particular networks, start working with carriers again. It's almost like we're going back, as Ara, you implied.
We are literally going back to 2010.
Yeah, you're seeing the granularity happening again, but I think it's coming from a different place. A lot of these phones are using the same foundation. So
they were Samsung, back then too. How many variants of the S2 did we have?
Right, but they all look different, right? They all had a completely different, they all had a different body and different feature set. Whereas this is basically just a metal and glass sandwich that they can reuse over and over again. The S10 Lite and the Note 10 Lite are virtually indistinguishable from the front, right? They are basically the same phone with different specs. And, you know, that's just going to continue. The A51 and A71 look very similar. How unique can you make a phone look anymore?
I mean, we could start doing actual cool colors again instead of just doing these prismatic sprays and then black and white.
Oh, somebody's going to fight you for that.
I want more pretty blue phones. I want more pretty green phones. I want more pretty purple phones. And those are all coming out in Asia, and none of them are coming here.
Daniel, I have to agree with Era. I don't want to buy a purple or a green phone. But I want them to be there for people that want to buy them.
Oh, I'm not disputing that. I just think every company is trying to follow particular trends.
Right. And you know, there's only one company setting those trends.
I mean, we got a Chromebook with a prismatic back at CES, and I want to try that sucker out. But
just
that's not the trend that I want.
Just because it has a prismatic back.
Well, I mean, it's also the follow-up to the C434, and I miss that Chromebook, so I want to play with it. But yes, I want to see how that prismatic back looks next to all the different shiny scales for the Epcot golf ball.
Girl.
So, okay, Galaxy S20, we know it's coming. We know that there are going to be at least three models. We know that there might be a foldable version.
Don't do it.
It was rumored to be called the Galaxy Bloom, but I think that was the internal name because we heard that it's now going to be the Z Flip, Galaxy Z Flip.
I can't imagine them ever calling a professionally released product a bloom, because my mind immediately goes to it blooms and then it rots.
That's a Florida thing, I think.
Just call it the Kin.
The Galaxy Swamp. All right, so let's move on and talk about the Pixel 4a. So in addition to there being three or more Galaxy S20 phones, there are now going to be maybe three Pixel 4a variants. And this comes to us from XDA. They're looking at the names of these phones, the internal names written within AOSP. Now, Jerry, as a developer, you understand that companies, especially when they're uploading to open source projects, they can't really hide everything that they're working on.
Right.
But they try to obscure it as much as possible. Google must know that people like Michal are digging into AOSP, you know, Git repositories. Oh, yeah. And whenever there's a new entry, they're trying to find little, you know, scratches of information.
Yeah, if you read some of those entries, it's obvious they know and they're having fun with it. So
totally. So why risk these leaks coming out, right? Why actually, you know, upload to Git to the repository at the, you know, at this point before the development is finished?
Well, because it's probably a collaborative project. And Google is working with Qualcomm, for example, you know, or any other company that does hardware and or software. And it's open source. You want to do that collaborative sharing thing as soon as you can to make the best product you can make. They use code names, and there's a very good chance that the three new code names we have, one of them is for a product that'll never see the light of day, or maybe even two of them. It's just some internal what if thing that they've got sitting on a bench somewhere they're playing with. That happens every day too. I think after looking at it that, yeah, we're going to see three Pixel 4As, the 4A, the 4A XL, and my money is going to be the 4A XL 5G.
So you actually think there will be a 5G version of the Pixel 4A?
They're not going to make the Pixel 4A XL 5G by default, because then their mid-range phone is now better than their high-end phone in a lot of people's eyes, even though it's not really, you know, 5G isn't a thing yet, but you know how people are. So
okay, so but that's going to make, you know, that's going to sort of force the cost up to 500-ish.
Probably.
Why would Google do that? I mean, the 3A XL is already 479, so we're close to 500. So let's say the two 4G phones, the LTE versions, are the same price, $399 and $479. Why put the Pixel 4A XL 5G up to $550 or $600, which is then coming close to the Pixel 4?
Two reasons. There are people who will want a 5G Pixel model, and they won't want to wait until November to get it. And they have to see what they can do with Android to optimize it for a 5G connection. And I don't just mean, you know, the networking stuff. 5G, you know yourself that the connection can be very spotty. You can have great service 1 minute and the next minute have really poor service, and then it goes back to great. There are probably a lot of things they can work on with inside Android itself to deal with that weird network latency, no latency thing that 5G gives us. And they've got to start somewhere. This is probably a good time to start. So this benefits Google, and they're going to sell a few of these things to people who really want a 5G branded Pixel.
If there are more than a handful of those, I would be very surprised.
Yeah, I'll bet they are still more popular than the regular Pixel 4.
I agree with that, because the Pixel 4a is going to have a regular fingerprint sensor, not going to have motion sense. So it's not going to have that big ugly chin.
Beautiful chin.
Necessary chin.
I have a Pixel 4, and motion sense is great when it works. It doesn't really do a whole lot yet.
Oh, motion sense is garbage. It should not have shipped this year. That is just it's a waste of a feature as it is.
I mean, if we could program our own gestures, and if it could connect to Tasker, it would have been brilliant.
That'll never happen until they release one without it. That's the thing. This goes back to the Nexus days. They've got to put the feature out there for developers to look at.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense for Google to put anything like motion display or face unlock in its cheaper phones, right?
No,
it's not going to happen. Not this year, probably not even next year. This is going to be a very, very typical, approachable mid-range phones, and they'll be great. And we know that they'll be great because the Pixel 3a was probably the best phone of 2019. And, you know, I've been using, I'm going to write about this at some point, but I've been using the Pixel 4 XL for the last couple of weeks. I took it with to Vegas, and because I was using the Pixel 4 reluctantly, because when I'm working, I'm always near a charger. It's easy. And I knew that if I was going to Vegas, I wanted the Pixel 4 with me because it has the best camera. It just works. But I did not want to deal with a bad battery, so I put my SIM in the Pixel 4 XL. And with the January patch, most of the issues that I had with it at launch are gone, right? The brightness issues, the fact that 90 hertz was only kicking in after like 75% brightness, those idiosyncrasies are gone. I turn off motion sense so I don't have to deal with it. Face unlock is reliable. So at this point, I'm very happy with it. And I'm going to write about how, just like every Google phone, I only like it after 3 months.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
But after 3 months, I love it. And I won't ever use another, I won't use another phone basically full time until the Pixel 5 comes out. And I got a lot of crap for reviewing the Pixel 4 as negatively as I did, right? I basically said to people, don't buy the Pixel 4. And I was talking specifically about the small one. And I'm going to stand by that because its battery life is so bad that if you want to use it for more than a few hours a day, you basically have to be a wall hugger. And I don't recommend that experience to anybody, even office workers. You don't want to have to rely on having a battery or a power outlet nearby. You should just be able to use your phone without thinking about it. The Pixel 4 XL gets me there most days, and I'm fine with the battery life.
Wireless charging batteries are a thing these days. So long as you keep them lined up in your pocket.
No, you should never have to do that. That's ridiculous.
Anecdotal evidence, the January patch improved battery life on the little Pixel 4 a lot. Yesterday, I had to drive across the state of West Virginia. And if you live in this part of the country, you know that that's something that nobody ever should want to do or have to do. But if you do, there's a huge portion of the state where you can move 5 feet and see your connection drop. And that just kills your battery life. And I made it where I needed to go and made it home and still had 30% of my battery left. That's never happened. The Pixel 4 has never been able to make that trip and still be turned on when I got home without charging it.
Well, I like the sound of that.
Still, at 30% at the end of the day, and most of that time was with me driving and not using it. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I mean, look, it's never going to be great.
Right.
So, whatever. All right, I want to talk. Sorry, last point, Ari.
Well, no. It was a personal question. Why weren't you charging your phone while you were driving? I mean, I feel like that's kind of a no-brainer.
Well,
damn, that's not nice. That's some shade.
I have a rule in my car. No, if you're behind the wheel, I would love to see you shut your phone off. In fact, I'm not getting Android Auto. I changed my mind. Even after I ordered it, I had to cancel my order and lose 10% restocking fee. I just don't like to see people fiddling with things while they're driving. So I don't care about my phone charging it, whatever. In my car, it just stays in my pocket with the ringer shut off, and I don't care what happens until I get somewhere and I can stop.
Yeah, but you know where you're going. I don't.
Well, yeah.
I need the map.
That's a different story. If you need to turn navigation on and Bluetooth it through your stereo, that I wouldn't have a problem with that. But to me, that's not fiddling with the phone necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of advantages to Android Auto, but it certainly does not avoid you picking up the phone every time.
I saw an advertisement for a chip you can wire into your reverse switch to make it so you can watch Netflix while the car's in motion, and that's what changed my mind completely. I'm like, you know, where people can't be trusted, and Android Auto is going to get somebody killed. No matter what Google does, it's just going to happen because people are people. So forget it. I just don't even want that temptation there. Not for myself, but maybe for other people in my family who might be driving my car.
So, Jerry, one of the other phones that was announced at CES, which wasn't really a production product, the OnePlus Concept One, it uses electrochromatic glass, and it kind of uses that to hide the camera bump or the cameras in the back. It also you know, does double duty as an ND filter. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And Pete Lau, in an interview with The Verge this week, confirmed that they're probably going to put it into production.
Good.
That they're going to bring it to some future phone. What do you think about this idea of adding, you know, unusual types of material to phones, especially as we're in this transition period between, you know, metal and glass sandwiches and more unique form factors like folding phones? You know, is there an advantage to this, or is it just sort of a last gasp?
Well, the advantage is uniqueness. I mean, if this thing comes to production, it looks even close to what the concept looked like, people are going to love how it looks. You actually got to touch the thing. I'm jealous. That's something that no other manufacturer is going to do before OnePlus makes it happen. Then it also is, it helps justify the price that it's going to be. It's going to cost a lot more than the OnePlus 9, you know, because it's not going to come out before then. So you're going to have this OnePlus 9 Plus, whatever they want to call it. And it's going to be, you know, $100 more because it has this feature. And this feature is so cool, people aren't going to care. They're going to think it's worth $100. I love to see this kind of innovation, because what if there is some other great, you know, benefit that we don't know because nobody's using it? And we come to find out later, hey, this also does, you know, the ND filter. The ND filter, I think, is amazing. A built-in ND filter over your camera lens that will definitely have an impact on the pictures you take is an awesome idea. And have it built in there all the time and make your software compensate for it when it's not needed. That's one huge benefit for a lot of people that they don't even know is going to exist. They're just going to know that this is the only phone that has it, and it's because of this cool chromatic glass stuff. So I like it. I think it's a great idea.
What do you think it adds to the bill of materials right now?
OnePlus has cost, you know, a few bucks here, a few bucks there, but then it's, you know, a different SKU means different supply chain, different paperwork. I'll bet it adds $50 to $75 to OnePlus's cost, which is going to equate to $100 for consumer cost. That's just an off-the-top guess.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, one can assume that it's going to be available in a shipping phone probably next year. Let's say the OnePlus, 9 or whatever it is.
Right.
And that may, you know, by then it'll have come down in price enough. But I do wonder if this stuff is really that useful to people and if it justifies the added cost. But I don't know. Ara, what do you think?
The ND filter capabilities of the chromatic glass for shooting outdoors in harsh sunlight, I mean, for vacations, for basically anything outside here in Florida, that ND filter is going to be very, yep, very useful.
Yeah, but you don't need electrochromatic glass to add an ND filter. It's just a side benefit of that product. If companies wanted to add them, they would just add them.
Yeah. But can we just all agree that it looks cool?
Oh, it's awesome. Does. Yeah.
And is there anything wrong with making something that just looks so different and so cool, and know that there are enough people that will buy it because it looks different and cool that they won't lose money on it? That's a good enough reason for me. Do it.
Just for the
do it for the lulz.
The lulz. I was going to say something that we can't print. all right, let's move on. I want to talk very quickly about this proposed regulation to in the EU to mandate USB ports on smartphones.
Andrew's so, wrong. It's a good thing. Done.
Okay. Yeah. This is interesting because there's a political side to it. Obviously, if you're a free market advocate, libertarian, you're not going to want the EU to start meddling in this kind of stuff, right? You want the market to take care of itself. And by and large, the market is taking care of itself. And I think this, let's just go through it. Okay. So basically what happened was in 2014, the EU had advocated a voluntary move to uniting smartphone ports, right? And this idea was that they wanted a common charging standard to fit all mobile phones, tablets, ebook readers, and other portable devices. And at that point, USB-C was still being developed. It hadn't been standardized, but it was on the way, and we knew that it was happening. We knew that that the USB Association was building something that would be reversible and it would be a lot more universal. Now, basically every phone you buy over $100 has USB-C, except the iPhone. And there mm-hmm. are some phones like Motorola's legacy Moto E line and a few phones from Chinese OEMs like Honor that may maintain the micro USB port. But Jerry, you may think it's good regulation, but the market is kind of dealing with this on its own.
No, it isn't.
Okay.
Apple users are a captive market. It's okay, I'm going to deal with lightning adapters, or I'm going to go to an entirely different new operating system and lose all of my apps and all of my Apple integration with everything.
Right. So Apple is separate, and I want to discuss that in a minute.
It's not just Apple. Daniel, you know I'm on the hunt for the perfect pair of wireless headphones. I've given up. Sorry, all my 3.5 friends out there. I gave up. I cry uncle. I just bought a pair of Aftershock Titaniums. Great, great headphones that charge with micro USB.
Yes.
I just want to shoot them for that. I want to put them on the fence post and shoot them with a shotgun just because of that. That's the market's not taking care of itself. I don't even have a micro USB cable, so I'm using that little 5-inch one that came in the box.
Yeah, no, I'm with Jerry. I've been searching for good USB-C over-ear headphones for the last 2 years, and the pair that I have right now are not USB-C spec, so I have to use the OnePlus charger whenever I want to charge them up.
Okay, so let's back up for a second. So we can agree that most phones, I would say 90% of all phones
and laptops
today,
and tablets.
Okay, hang on. Let's one thing at a time.
Okay.
Because I agree with you. I'm not playing devil's advocate here, but I do want to acknowledge that the market, in terms of the most popular consumer electronic product in history, the smartphone, is slowly but surely taking care of itself. There are exceptions, and I agree with you, but most phones released today, even cheap ones, use USB-C. There are standouts, and I would like those to be resolved. But then there are the other more, you know, margin sensitive products out there. The ones like, you know, truly wireless earbuds, like e-readers, like crappy Android tablets that, yes, are, you're absolutely right. They still use micro USB and it drives me up the wall. I bought a pair of $130 Amazon Echo Buds a couple of months ago and it still uses USB-C. I mean, micro USB. It's unconscionable, especially for a product that considers itself premium.
For headphones, it's a matter of, yeah, it's something that is much more sensitive to that price margin and that profit margin. But at the same time, most headphone manufacturers are they're finally getting the idea that, oh, hey, people want to use the same cable for their phone and their phone and their headphones again, like they could when we were all micro USB. So they're slowly making the rounds. But they're not going fast enough, and I don't think we're going to be able to legislate them moving faster than they are.
Daniel, you make the EU's point though without realizing it. You have to use a separate charger and a separate cable for your Amazon Buds. That creates more e-waste, just like the EU says this is going to stop. That's what the entire. Their reason behind this initiative, at least their public reason, was that the all this e-waste has got to just be put to an end. And you just created more by buying Amazon Buds. I just created more by buying Aftershock induction headphones. So we're proving the EU's point.
But the EU only wants to enforce this for smartphones right now, right?
Right.
Sure. And that's a big step. But I also will say that the more important thing is the assumption that most people already have sufficient numbers of cables and chargers in their house, in their possession, and that many products should not come with any charging capabilities at all, right? They should not come with charging cables or AC adapters.
Excellent point.
And if we're going to take those measures, if we're going to go the step to standardizing our charging port, we need to acknowledge that what is the actual reason here? Is it to democratize charging? I do want to talk about Apple's position here, because Apple is, if you want to make the argument, it is the biggest problem,
right?
In this equation, and that this is something that is probably not going to happen because of Apple, because Apple will push back so hard.
And it's also really important. The EU doesn't want to mandate USB-C. They want to mandate a single charging interface.
Sure, exactly. And that's a good distinction. Although,
right.
I mean, the chances of it being USB-C are basically 100%.
Yeah, it's going to be USB-C. Unless Apple says everybody can use Lightning for free, it'll be USB-C.
Even if they say everybody can use Lightning for free, it would still be USB-C because Lightning can't do like any higher power charging for laptops. That's part of why I love USB-C. I have one charger that I can bring with me to the parks, and it'll charge my Chromebook, it'll charge my phone, it'll charge my headphones if I bring my earbuds instead of my over-ear headphones. I have a power bank in my gear bag, and it has 60-watt power delivery output, so I can charge my Chromebook at full speed or my phone at full speed.
You also mentioned that some products will just not take a charge from a C2C cable because some products they don't support PD. That is a problem, but it's also a very obscure problem. Like, for example, I have two cables next to me when I work. I have an A to C cable and I have a C to C cable. And I was charging my headphones. I put them in there expecting them to be done by the time I left to take my dog for a walk, and they were dead when I took them off the charger, not realizing that I charged them with the C2C cable, and they just didn't take any power at all. So, I mean, how do we even solve the fact that today in 2020, USB-C is still a gong show?
The USB-C doesn't enforce their suggested guidelines. That's the problem.
Power delivery does, right?
No, they don't enforce any of it. You can make a widget with a USB-C port on it that does anything, a phone, a television, whatever, and you can use that port however you want. It used to be a big problem, you know, when Qualcomm was using it in weird ways, and they were within their rights to do that. The USB-C USB consortium, I don't know who it is.
USB consortium hadn't agreed on the spec yet. So people were just like, okay, there's no spec. I'm just going to do what I want.
Even today, you can get your product certified, but you don't have to. You can just use it. It's free and open. I hate to see anything not become less free and less open. But if you want to make everything interoperable, the first thing you have to do is mandate specifications for every single person that's going to use it.
Or you just have to trust people to buy certified products. I was looking at chargers this week to recommend in an article, and one of the Amazon Basics chargers isn't certified, so it's not getting in there.
Right, but you are the exception. You know what a certified charger is. And Jerry, going back to the fact that people, you know, I brought up the fact that most people already have cables and chargers. Most people don't know whether those chargers and cables are of good quality, especially if they're USB-C. So if you got a $20 or $30 pair of true wireless earbuds off Amazon, even if they charge via USB-C, the cable is probably going to be pretty crappy And if it comes with an AC adapter, it's going to be like, you know, 10 or 12 watts.
Yeah.
I mean, that's more than enough for a pair of earbuds, but maybe it's just poor quality altogether so that they can save money and still advertise the fact that they charge via USB-C. I have a couple pairs of earbuds that I just received in the mail. They're under $50 and they charge via USB-C. And that's something that we're going to see a lot in 2020 because all of these companies are basically using the same, you know, turnkey templates
right.
To build these products. And now USB-C has come down in price enough that they can advertise it as being USB-C friendly.
Yep. It's a mess. I jokingly said Andrew's wrong, end of discussion. This is a mess that somebody needs to do something about. Maybe the EU's not doing it the right way, but at least somebody's bringing it to everyone's attention that, look, this is a mess that has to be fixed. You know, whether
well, if we want to talk about e-waste, let's talk about the crappy little cables that you get at gas stations and at UPS offices, and they sell three different kinds. They sell a USB-A to Lightning, they sell a USB-A to USB-C, and they sell a USB to micro USB. We don't need all of these little crap accessories. We need good accessories that can last a long time. That's the e-waste that needs to be cut down, and we're not going to be able to do anything about that unless those companies just go out of business, which I don't think is really going to happen.
But then they built it, and they have tons of inventory that they need to get rid of.
Exactly.
You know, the stuff is being built.
Just because it's inexpensive doesn't mean it's crap.
Oh, absolutely. I've got a $13 USB-C charger right here. It's the size of a quarter, and it charges at 18 watts. It's going to last me the next 5 years, and I love it.
The whole problem with USB-C cables that we had, you know, originally was because they weren't being built right. The cost factor was for a penny, you could build 100 of them the correct way. And it was just they were being built without the correct wiring configuration, and that was frying devices. Right. I don't want to disparage your favorite USB cable that you bought at the gas station for a buck and a half, because it could be a great cable. It's just copper wire.
But I mean, this is like the standards. It's really complicated. I would love to talk about this in comparison to say something like HDMI, because, you know, HDMI has been accused of, you know, not every cable port looks the same, but the actual standards that are built into some of those cables are older. They won't support new features. But at the end of the day, that is the kind of argument that companies like Monster get away with charging $60 for an HDMI cable, because they're saying we're leveraging the latest standards to provide the highest performing HDMI cable. But in reality, if you could buy a $4 HDMI cable that does the exact same thing and supports the latest standards,
because of monoprice.
And also, but that's the same with USB-C. It's just that most companies are not doing that yet.
Right. And if you don't know any better, the best thing you can do is spend too much money and buy something that you know works
from a brand, and you're paying for the brand, really, right. Not necessarily for the technology.
Well, no, the best thing you can do is come to androidcentral.com and search, and we will tell you which ones work and which ones don't. But right. Most people, if they don't know, they equate price, you know, with quality.
Yeah, and that's not going to change anytime soon. I mean, there are companies like Anker, Aki, that are building really high quality products that aren't that expensive. And there are plenty of them around. So if you want to get our recommendations, you know, might as well plug it. While we're here, go to Android Central. I think it's search for best USB-C cables. We have a pretty good roundup.
Yep.
Okay, let's move on. I just want to talk quickly before we go about this Steam coming to Chromebooks rumor. This was a little tidbit that was shared with Android Police's editor-in-chief, David Ruddick, friend of the pod. And what was said was specifically that Google anticipates there will be, like the Galaxy Chromebook from Samsung, higher performance Chromebooks released throughout 2020 that have more powerful GPUs. And Google is ostensibly going to work with Valve to officially support Steam using the Linux for Chrome OS platform. But Jerry, as far as I know, you can already run Steam on a Chromebook in some form. So right. Why is this a big deal?
Because as of today, you have no GPU hardware acceleration in Chrome OS. I mean, I've got the Steam app on my Pixelbook Go. And a lot of the games, the really light games, they run okay. But I can't, like, for instance, install Skyrim on it. And Skyrim is, what, 10 years old now? And it won't run. It's just a 3-frame-per-second nightmare because to Skyrim, there is no GPU because you just can't use hardware acceleration. I'm willing to bet that what is going to happen is we're going to see support for Intel's Iris GPUs that are on the core chips. You know, I think that's the 9th generation, 8th generation, somewhere they started putting Iris GPUs inside the processors, and it's a better GPU than they used to use. We've also got the new AMD APUs that are appearing in Chrome OS products, and APU stands for Application Processing Unit, and it has GPU support and regular CPU support built into one chip. And on the GPU side, it works a little bit better than Intel. But Chrome OS doesn't support all of that stuff to play games yet. If Steam officially comes to the Chromebook without you having to enable Linux, go download the Steam Debian package, and then install the one library that's missing, and then just run the package and install Steam, and then everything just works poorly, but it works. Officially, that's not official. Officially means I go somewhere, I click a button, and I install Steam to my Chromebook, and it just works, and it works a lot better than it does now, which is a pretty big deal.
Okay, so the obvious question I have when I hear you talking about that and all that work that's going into building GPU acceleration support into Chrome isn't Google doing all of this in the cloud? And aren't the best games that you can find on Steam eventually going to be available on Stadia, which is Google's purpose-built streaming platform that you can already play yes. Chrome OS in a browser? Why the hell would you want local Steam support on a $250 Chromebook? Which makes up the vast, vast majority of right, Chromebooks right. out there.
Because even Google recognizes that Time Warner and Comcast don't have unlimited data for a whole lot of people. And you can eat up your, 20 gigabytes, whatever they give you a month, playing games in the first 10 days of the month, and then you're kind of screwed. That was my first guess as to why they would want this. Number two, you get to partner with Valve. Anybody that can partner with Valve, you make money from that instantly. It may not turn out to be successful in the long run. Look at the HTC Vive compared to what Oculus has done. But HTC originally partnered with Valve, and in the early days of VR, the Vive was the go-to VR headset. And they could charge more for it, and it had built-in Steam integration, and you turned it on, and Steam had a special VR mode. Everything just worked, and it was wonderful. And short-term solution, that made it more popular than the competition. So partnership with a gaming company like Valve, if you want to attract gamers, is nothing to sneeze at. And number three, let's go back to that coolness factor. I can do everything on my Chromebook except edit video for real, long amounts of time or play AAA games unless I stream them. Well, now this could solve that AAA gaming thing.
Right.
And that could make Chromebooks much more lucrative to a vastly growing number of people.
No, because what Daniel said, most people own a $250 Chromebook. The experience is not going to be great, but I'm willing to spend more on a Chromebook because I use them so much. This helps justify that cost even more.
Yeah, no, I get that. And It's still unlikely, and I don't think it'll ever be likely, that people will jump, you know, go out of their way or jump up to buy a $1,000 Chromebook. And I really don't think that this Samsung Galaxy Chromebook, which is being kind of positioned as the Pixelbook 2, is going to sell in numbers, because the Pixelbook didn't sell in numbers. And no $1,000 Chromebook is ever going to sell in numbers. But I just find it interesting. I find it interesting that this is something that Google is even pursuing, given its lack of attention in this field to date, right? The fact that it's having such a hard time getting developers to build experiences for Chrome natively. I just wonder how useful this is going to be. But that's just sort of that's the cynical part of me coming out. I don't know if that's how I really feel.
You're absolutely right. I touched on that a couple weeks back, that the biggest problem with these $1,000 Chromebooks is heat. I don't care. You can put the best Intel Core i7, even go with i9. Well, no, you couldn't. You can't even put an i9 in there, because it wouldn't even be able to turn on without throttling. Heat kills these fanless, super thin Chromebooks. That's why I don't have a lot of faith in the new Galaxy Chromebook to be any better than the original Pixelbook. That's not to say it's not going to be a great Chromebook and do a lot of great, cool things on Chrome, but it doesn't mean I'm instantly going to be able to render 4K video, because if I wanted to do that now, I turn it on and then check it in the morning and hope that it's finished, because everything throttles so slow, it's just a mess. There are a few Chromebooks out there that have actual heat sinks and fans, and I'm going to have to hit up a couple companies to see if I can reborrow one of them if this Steam support becomes a real thing, because that could be interesting. You have a heat, a thermal solution built in, and right, now you have hardware acceleration. And now if I can play Skyrim on a Chromebook,
you'll never come back to work.
Well,
Jerry.
No, Hayato's going to get on a plane to West Virginia and we're going to make 30-minute video of Jerry playing Skyrim on a Chromebook.
I think you should just Twitch stream that every day.
Totally.
Just start
That's
doing
my
that
new
full
job.
Time. I'm fine with that, because you'd get so many people watching you. You'd swear so much. It'll be like the most you'll basically beat Ninja at his own game. Although I don't think Ninja swears. I think he's family friendly. So
I'm family friendly.
Yeah, you're family friendly in like a cuddly way, but then you like bust out an F-bomb and everybody's like, wait a second. He's not as tame as we thought.
There's the Jerry we all know and love.
All right, so last thoughts on this. What do you think is the kind of 5-year plan for Chrome OS aside from Steam support? Like, do you see it becoming a more full-featured OS at some point, or is Google just going to double down on what's happening, focusing on enterprise and education?
Focusing on enterprise and education has worked out pretty well for them so far, but I think you can already do pretty much everything except hardcore video editing and hardcore gaming on a Chromebook. You can do regular to light video editing through web apps and through Android apps. You can use Android apps for pretty much any productivity besides CAD rendering and like quantum computing of some kind. I think it's about making Chromebooks look cool for mostly being $300, $200 to $400 laptops. It's about having these $1,000 Chromebooks that look awesome in order to help pull away the Chromebooks are just cheap disposable computers idea that Chromebooks have accumulated over the last 10 years.
Right. Yeah, I guess so. Because
the Chromebook that I'm sitting here on right now is $300, has an aluminum lid, and it's nice, pretty pink. It's a touchscreen, and it's got 64 gigabytes of storage, which is all I need once I slap a micro SD card in it.
Yeah, but you can't record this podcast on it because it doesn't run Audacity. You still need a Windows PC for that.
Yeah, it does. Follow the guide I just wrote.
Yeah,
it's three clicks, and Audacity's installed, and except it doesn't support microphones.
Oh yeah, so that little,
what?
That little
I'm
you can
sorry.
Run Audacity.
What?
Yeah, that's helpful. Thanks, Jerry. So, I mean, that's what I'm saying, right? Like, if you want to build, if you want to record a podcast running Skype and Audacity at the same time, you still can't do that. And that's just annoying and stupid. And it shouldn't be an issue in 2020.
I mean, how many people podcast?
No, that's not even the point. It's like there are so many things you say about it. Like, how many people do X on their Windows or Mac PCs? And those things add up, right? How many people edit photos? How many people edit videos? How many people do pro?
But regular CAD-ing? Photo editing you can do.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really, and it's still.
Yeah, you can.
Oh, editing photos maybe, but there's nothing. You know, Lightroom is bad. Lightroom on a Chromebook is just still, it's bad.
Jerry, do they have Linux versions of the Adobe Creative Suite?
No, but they have replacements that work in some cases better, but like most Linux apps, the UI is just a dumpster fire and you'll hate it. And I say that as a fan of Linux apps. Nobody that writes them cares about the user experience, just the results.
Yeah. Well, I've got Pixlr X and that's good enough for me 95% of the time. And the other 5% of the time I crank out this Surface Pro 3 that I've had from Russell for the last 4 or 5 years and break out Photoshop and a little bit of Skype and Audacity for podcasting, and that's it. That's all I keep a Windows machine around for.
Well, and I just want to say before we have to cut out of here, we keep saying Chromebooks. Steam support for the Chromebox is a game changer.
Yeah, but how many Chromebox? We were just having this conversation today. There's like 3 Chromeboxes out there.
Yeah, but hopefully... you know, the rumor that all these companies have plans for new ones to come out sometime in, you know, the second quarter of this year turns out to be true. And that this also gets integrated with a Chromebox. And now you have an actual viable alternative to the PlayStation or the Xbox for your TV.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited. I'm excited to see what happens with it. I'm excited to see more features arrive on Chrome OS, more professional apps and features, and
like
just
Steam.
More people using it. Yeah, like Steam.
I'm a professional.
You're
Steam.
You're a pro. You're a pro.
I'm a Steam pro. They pay me to give them money.
Yeah. Yeah. They take your money for free. All right, so we'll end there. Thank you so much, guys. This has been super fun. Happy, have a great weekend, and happy Friday night. If you like what you heard, send us an email, podcast@androidcentral.com. We love hearing from you. Let us know at that email what you think about Chrome OS today. There's been a lot of controversy about the state of Chrome. I want to hear from you. Do you use a Chromebook? Do you use a Chromebox? Do you dabble? Or is it just Chrome in your browser on a Mac or PC? So let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Jerry, people can find you at GB Hill, R at R Wagco. You can find us all at androidcentral.com. My name is Daniel. Have a great weekend.
Adios.
Peace.